Must life always be hard for God's followers? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide, as we continue our series on Jeremiah. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas and Matilda Fry, the Walla Walla University School of Theology. Now, our lesson for this one is a fascinating one, because in the official study guide, they talk about Jeremiah's yoke, and they give it two different applications. The memory verse suggested is one which says that yoke is the burdensome life, which we certainly see in Jeremiah, because they say, if you want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. Now, if you take Jeremiah's life as the example, then it's going to be a fairly bitter experience. So my question is, does it have to be that way for all of us?
History would say no.
Is it possible? Are there buoyant Christians?
Yeah, and I think there have been, not only are there buoyant Christians, I think there have been some eras in which believers have lived very happy and unchallenged lives. Mm-hmm. But that usually is not good for the church. You know, there's a saying, Reinhold Niebuhr said, he quoted something that times of adversity, meaning in society for the church, times of prosperity in the society are for the church times of adversity, but times of adversity in the culture are times of prosperity.
Yeah.
Is that it's because in prosperity or in adversity you are forced to really test and examine the commitments you have made to God, whereas in times of prosperity you're not. And you juxtapose the circumstance of Christianity in America versus that in China, and you see precisely the dynamic that he's talking about.
And there is great danger in prosperity.
Yeah.
We know the church that lives in times of persecution or hard times is a growing church.
Yeah. Vibrant.
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in a communist system, and the church was very active and very much together.
Was it illegal?
Certain things were illegal.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you had to live around the law and hope not to be caught.
Yes. But the religion, the life with God.
Oh, was very alive, yeah.
Was very alive. We would meet very much more often than in the free country where I moved later on.
Uh-huh. But what about the personal religious experience in that difficult time? Wasn't there a certain joy and buoyancy when you would come together for worship?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Very much. And if people had adversity, it was not the focus of their life, right?
Yes. You see, that adversity that was kind of like a separate life.
Yeah.
You had a life that was hard and difficult, and then you had the other part. And you always were looking forward to those times to meet with your brothers and sisters, to meet in community, in the church.
You know, I have to tell a story, Alden, that I knew a man years ago who, when he became a Christian, his wife was very angry. And she was not sure she would play second fiddle to God. But it was interesting to see him come to church, because every morning when he left, every Sabbath morning when he left his home to come to church, his wife would display anger. We have things to do here, we have the kids, but he would leave for church. And almost every Sabbath there was some tension or fight at home. But he used to drive 8 miles to church, and I've never seen anybody come into church with such joy. He would jump 3 steps at a time, and he would burst in there. And one day I said to him, his name was Ken, I said, Ken, what is with this bursting into? And he said, every Sabbath I leave those who not only don't understand me, the deepest joys and longings of my heart, and on the way down here I realize I'm coming to be with those who do. And he says, by the time I get here, I'm just overjoyed.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. Good. Well, I think there is a kind of a popular sense that religion is not very fun. In fact, I have a quote from a card that my daughter gave me. It's a Mark Twain quote. Now, he was not a religious man, but his statement was rather intriguing. He says, the only way to keep your health is to eat what you don't want, drink what you don't like, and do what you'd rather not. So the disciplined life is not a happy one. And, of course, when you bring God into that, than a See, God.
But I don't agree with Mark Twain.
Well, I don't either.
Because there is a certain joy that comes with self-discipline. What do we achieve in life by just following our own impulses?
Yep. You know?
But I'm interested in this yoke, Alden, because a yoke, when you talk about it, it seemed to be very burdensome and you know, it's like, oh my, this thing is on my neck. But most yokes are made for two. Uh-huh. And so if you are an ox and you plow with a single yoke, I don't know that they even do that. You know, the burden of plowing is shared between two oxen, not just one. So there is actually a very interesting positive side to a yoke. I would rather plow in a yoke than not in one.
Well, a yoke is supposed to make life easier for you.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's what Jeremiah was thinking.
No.
He was thinking of something stuck around your neck, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But, of course, I think of the statement in Matthew, Jesus' statement, come to me, all you that are weary and are carried.
Yes.
Yeah, my yoke is easy.
My yoke is easy, and my burden is light. So,
But I would say even that doing right and living righteously is easy, even as the circumstances, you know, the sense you have of fulfillment and purpose and joy and what other adjective you want to put in there supersedes the difficulties that it may bring on you.
I think that's particularly the case if you don't see God demanding self-denial, but it is a self-denial which is willingly given.
Yeah.
And for me, that's very important, because if you tell me I have to love my wife, I mean, if she tells me you have to love me, that's not going to work. You know, love cannot be commanded. It's something which flows naturally, and then it becomes a great joy. So,
and you know, don't we really admire the sacrifice that love produces sometimes?
Yes.
I mean, I think of a relative of mine whom I never knew, but lived in England, and his wife was put into a so-called insane asylum. We don't use those words anymore. But for many years, he went there and visited with her, even though she didn't know who he was. You know, he would bring her a flower, okay, because he said, that's my wife. Even if she doesn't know me,
yeah,
I still love her. Wow, we admire those kind of things. We don't admire selfishness.
No, there is a certain beauty to one who says, even though it was not the life that we used to have together, I have promised, and I'm going to keep my promise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and what would life be like if every time things turn a bit difficult, you say, well, I'm going to go look for someone else?
Or, and I mean, you look at in the Western world, we admired Mother Teresa for how many years was she at the top of the most admired person list, and what did she do? I mean, she did the thing that nobody else wanted to do. She took care of unwanted dying people.
Yeah.
Okay.
And wasn't that a yoke for her?
Well, of course.
For her personally.
Oh.
We read about her that she was also very depressed many times.
Yeah. She wondered if God even loved her.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet we admire her, you know.
Mm. Yeah. She lost the sense of God's presence, which was for her a very grievous thing.
Yeah.
You know, and so. But we need to look at now the illustration in Jeremiah's own day, the wooden yoke, and this is the one where, you know, I think it's more important to look at the historical situation. It apparently came in the fourth year of Zedekiah, and that would be about 593, some 6 years before the fall of Jerusalem.
Mm.
But it's maybe some 15 years after the conditional prophecy early in the reign of Jehoiakim. Now, the question behind this is, does there come a point of no return? Now, when we say no return, I'm not talking about personal salvation. We're talking about the circumstances in Jerusalem. You know, if they had gone, the Lord would still be with them. They would have come back. It had nothing to do with personal salvation. It just had to do with their relationship to their city and their land. But it seems to me that by the time you get to Zedekiah, things have moved along quite a bit, and you can no longer directly say, all right, this is a conditional prophecy. Would you agree with that? Or is there always hope?
Well, I do think as I read the prophets, I do think that there comes a point where conditional prophecy runs out, and now the die is cast, so to speak.
And Jeremiah would say, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved.
Yeah. But I think that the conditionality of a when the prospect of repentance, or as you said, Matilda, turning around is gone, I think then the conditionality tends to fade.
Well, in the story, the prophet Hananiah, the false prophet, tells that the yoke would be broken and the people would return. And Jeremiah comes with the yoke and demonstrates it. And then the false prophet takes it away from him and destroys it.
Breaks it. That's
breaks
right.
It. Yeah. Yes. So whatever you, however you look at it, it is a yoke. It's going to be a yoke from both sides. Only that the false prophet says it will end and there and brings the good news.
Yeah, he was predicting the return of Jehoiachin, yeah. Return of the temple vessels, and within 2 years.
Yes.
And Jeremiah said, in fact, I don't think there's a record in the text where Jeremiah replaced the wooden yoke with an iron one, but he used that rhetoric.
Yes.
Yeah, he says, you don't like the wooden yoke? Guess
it
what?
Will be...
I've got an iron yoke.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a lot worse.
Mm.
So now I wanted to draw a parallel here with another aspect that you find several times. In fact, it is troubling in one sense, where the Lord tells Jeremiah, do not pray for this people.
Yeah.
There are at least three times, 7:16, 11:14, 14:11, do not pray for this people. Is that linked with the iron yoke? Or should we experience Jonah's call to Nineveh as something that always gives us hope?
No, I think that the remarkable thing about the story of Jonah is that one preaching episode over however many days results in the complete turnaround of the whole place. Jeremiah spends how many years? 40 years after Isaiah has preceded him, Daniel, Ezekiel, you got all these people, and there's no turning around. So I see this, don't pray for these people. It's a very powerful statement. Look, there's no point. They're not going to turn around. Their hearts are hardened. They're not changing.
And that must have had some kind of shock value. And the prophet says, no, the Lord has told me I can't pray for you. It is too late. See, the summer has ended. The harvest is past.
We are not saved.
And we are not saved. I think that's it's a very
grim. There is also the part in that saying, in that the word of God, that when you look at the prophet, he is somebody who is on the people's side,
yes.
Who intercedes for the people.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, what Jeremiah did, we'll maybe look at this a bit more, is he promised a return.
Yes.
Not just the quick return that Hananiah wanted. Yeah. And I think that's a crucial point. Well, my thanks to both of you for helping out today. My thanks to David Olson, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in for The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.